Right. So, look, as part of the Red Meat Profitship, Red Meat Profit Partnership, I beg your pardon, which Beef and Lamb New Zealand are a significant partner and investor in, there's been a lot of work around how we can, how Beef and Lamb New Zealand can do our role for farmers better, how we can communicate information better and help farmers make informed business decisions, which is a key reason why we exist. This podcast itself was actually one of the outcomes from that. It was seen as a complementary way of getting information out there. But one of the key lessons, or I guess we already knew it, it was reinforced, is that farmers like to learn from other farmers, from those who've done it. It's not just theory or a bit of research, but it's actually been put in practice and some of the wrinkles worked out. And that consistently ranks highly as a way of getting information. So tonight's guest has a track record of farming well in a tough environment, as you'll hear shortly. Along with his brothers, Peter Young was really well known in Central Otago farming circles and has now moved into farm advisory work, and so his reputation has spread even further. So for on this podcast, he's an ideal guest with his background on the farm and his experience now in helping farmers identify opportunities, how to seize those opportunities and how to communicate important information with farmers. So welcome to the call, Peter. We're going to hook in shortly with a few key messages before we get in the Q&A, but normally start with a wee bit of background as well. So you're actually not from Central Otago originally, are you? And ended up farming not through the traditional family farming type route. Can you give us a bit of a potted history of how you ended up where you are?
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. Good evening, everybody. I was actually brought up in South Canterbury. My father was farming just out of Fairley when I was born, and he sold the farm in 1971, and with five boys and two girls, and at least three of those boys subsequently went farming, possibly a fourth would have, and so we got onto farming by our own means, and I went into partnership with my brother Don, and we through contract fencing initially. After we did a stint of various other things, Don was shepherding and I did a bit of shepherding and stock agent and what have you, we got the opportunity to lease a farm in the Maniatoto from the Stringer family, and we continued to lease that property for 23 years, and it allowed us to get the opportunity to lease an additional property and then subsequently purchase a property in the Ida Valley, which Kirsty and I went to and stayed there for about 17 or 18 years, Aaron.
I should point out, and then Peter mentioned he was a stock agent. He had some very high quality clients at times in his career, that being the Meikle family. So Peter and I have got a wee bit of history right back to when he was on the farm, or a stock agent for my parents' farm. And he was also, I spent some time in Central Otago. He was a great shoulder to lean on for a very green young farm consultant back in the late 1990s. Anyway, wasn't about our personal history, Peter. We want to get on a bit about some farming stuff. So
absolutely.
I know Peter is a treasure trove of ideas and opinions, to be fair, but you know, it's backed up with experience. So we're going to dig into that a wee bit later on. But again, Peter, just want to give you the chance. There's a few key messages the take home messages, I guess. So hand over to you to start with those.
I guess the foundation philosophy for farming sheep in general, but achieving performance from a breeding flock, was really cemented when we moved to the Ida Valley and to Tirihua. The property when we moved there was performing at a reasonably low level. Lambing at that stage was 92%, and we really had to start from ground level to change that, and it's a fairly challenging environment, and it really cemented in place for me some of the basic fundamentals of farming to achieve performance. And for me, it was, if you break it down to basically simple things, for me it was finding genetics that actually fitted the environment and what you're trying to do in that environment, and with a daily goal really of striving to eliminate or at least minimize stress on your animals every day. And that's really the foundation behind all of the decisions you make on a daily basis. When that's in the back of your mind, it supports production. And and while it sounds like a fairly simple philosophy, I think high performance is relatively simple. It's the implementation of that high performance in specific environments where the challenge really starts, and applying the proven principles and the science behind it to the limitations of your environment as best you can. And to try and achieve that, I certainly had a focus on feeding, and more recently it's probably, I don't describe it as feeding anymore, it's more nutrition. And I, for many years before I sold the farm, I had a strong focus on body condition scoring ewes, and part of that too was a fairly comprehensive animal health plan that's helped worked out by health professionals, and getting a really good understanding of what the critical periods were in the year to support repeatable production, and understanding the production cycle and any potential threats to that repeatable performance, so that try to be one step ahead of that. And I guess finally, we placed a lot of emphasis on monitoring specific aspects that were key to production, and using that information to try and look for opportunities to improve, and relating that to what had happened during that season. And sometimes we would make spectacular progress by accident, and the key to me was understanding why that happened, and trying to put in place circumstances that ensured that you could deliver on that every year, that it was no longer an accident. But a key part of that was you know, observing what was happening closely enough that you could recognize what worked and what didn't work and act accordingly. So there's a lot of things that flow from that basic philosophy of just trying to remove stress from their lives. But to me, it's been a good foundation stone, really, to base my whole farming philosophy on.
Great. So you've covered a lot of stuff there, and we're going to dig into some of those in detail. But I just want to, again, set the scene a wee bit. Tell us a bit about, you know, you farmed at a couple of places, but I mean, latterly it was at Otirihua. Tell us a bit about that farm at Otirihua. You talked about stock stress. That's a farm that put stock under stress at several times of the year for different reasons.
Well, we moved there in June of 1991, and within 3 days it snowed and we didn't see the ground for 7 weeks, and that was the one of the hardest winters they had for a long time. We had about 3 weeks of minus 20, and it got to about minus 10 during the day, and it was the winter when we had sheep frozen to the ground and 2 inches of ice, new ice on the water every morning. So there's certainly some challenges related to that environment. And I recall the first lambing we had there, only 60% of the tudus actually reared lambs. So I very quickly had a real strong focus on making sure that we grew our young stock out properly, that we had realistic culling and selection policies in place, that we knew which animals were performing and which weren't, and culled accordingly. And we actually made relatively quick progress in terms of our lambing percentage and our lamb weights. We could only renew our pastures at a certain rate, and I couldn't see any point in artificially stimulating the conception rates, and it had to be driven from the ground up. So through feeding and selection and culling and understanding what traits the animals needed to perform in that environment, I think it proved to be a very valuable lesson to take with me in the following years, really.
Okay. So let's come back to some of the management stuff. Let's talk about feeding, and it was something, certainly in my time in Central Otago, all the young brothers were well known for, was feeding of stock. That translated into some pretty big ewes. I think I remember, may not have been you, but the shearer's asking one of your brothers when they were going to be TB tested when he looked in the catching pen. What's your thoughts on ewe size and weighing ewes and hoggets as a management tool?
I think there's an element of natural growth in certain environments, and the Maniatato, for example, has a reputation for being incredibly healthy stock country and for naturally growing animals really large. And I recall my brother being concerned about the condition score of some of his ewes one year, and when he managed to cram a couple into the weighing crate, he found they were 80 kilos. And they were, you know, no different genetics from anything else. And a lot of that goes back to specific types of country growing animals extremely well. And that was not particularly something distinctive of young brothers. It was something that was very common in the general region. And I found when I moved into the Ida Valley that there wasn't the natural sweetness in the country, and the stock didn't grow to the same size. And from that, I sort of decided that this country that is better suited to finishing and this country that's better suited to breeding. And subsequently, we didn't have some of those issues related to animal size and leg and feet trouble and lambing issues and that they might have had in some other areas where sometimes lambs were a bit overgrown or it was too easy to get used too heavy. So I think there's definitely something in the environment that influences that. But I also think that it's more efficient if you can have a smaller ewe producing her own live weight in weaned lamb every year, without a doubt. With that obviously comes a bit more load and a bit more potential stress on those ewes too. So we have to be very mindful of how we manage them.
So you talked about a couple of different things there. When you're working with farmers now, do you bother with the weight of the ewes, or are you solely focused on body condition scoring as a way of just working the what sort of nick they're in basically versus how big their frame may be?
I'm very interested in the condition score of the ewes, but I'm also interested in their development or their feeding through their development years, because that certainly influences how well they grow. But I'm also very mindful of the fact that animals need to grow to fit the country they have to operate on, and particularly so in hill country situations where ewes have to climb and climb to quite some considerable altitude in some properties. There's no advantage in a very large framed heavy bodied ewe. Mm-hmm. So I think really it's horses for courses, and they need to fit the country they're being asked to produce on.
And we're going to dig into it more because you and I have been talking about it, and I've heard from some of the people you talk about around body condition scoring being an essential tool to manage individual ewes rather than a flock as a whole. So you talked, I think, in your intro about key focus of your management was maintaining all the ewes above a body condition score threshold, above a minimum, all year, and trying to reduce the variation within the flock through the year. So can you be a wee bit more precise, maybe put some scores around that, what you're talking, what you're aiming for minimums, the sort of range you want? And I know you've got some thoughts on getting too high at the upper end as well.
Yeah, my goal was always to try and have all ewes above a condition score of 3 at any time of the year. And preferably heading into the autumn and winter, I would be happier if they were 3.5 or 4. With that, I believe we also need to watch that we don't actually put too many ewes out too much over that condition score 4, because I think that potentially there's associated problems with that heavy condition that needs to be managed also. And stock remarkably can find ways to die. They just find other ways to die when they're being very well fed, and that might be bearings, it might be cast, it could be lambing trouble. So I think it's equally important to control intakes and try and minimise that variation in condition scores. I was a very happy camper if I could have had all of my ewes at 3.5 condition score and nothing over 4 and nothing under 3.
So on your own place, or when you're dealing with other farms, I presume by condition scoring, you have to put your hand on their back to do it. And when you started doing it yourself, or when you get clients starting to do it, what are they seeing? Do they think they can do it by eye? And then when they put their hand, what sort of range are they seeing in flocks?
A lot of people think they can achieve successful condition scoring by eye. I would have to say, even with recently shorn sheep, that's extremely difficult. And I've run the odd workshop for some bigger corporate clients to try and train their staff and educate them to that fact. And I've had very, very good stockmen who have asked to take out everything over condition score 3 on the drafting gate and ewes that have been shorn for less than 10 days. And the very best of them still get 30% of them wrong. And so I think there's no replacement for physically putting a hand on them, because in that instant you're treating a ewe as an individual, and when we're asking a lot more of our ewes than we did 20 or 30 years ago, we need to have the confidence that we've got them to where they need to be at the right time, and it's really the only way that we can truly be confident of that.
So yourself or with your client, what times of the year, how often would you recommend body condition score the ewe flock, and what are the key times of the year they should be having a look?
We ended up doing it really no more than 3 times a year for us, because we found there was no advantage in condition scoring through the winter, because we did it regularly enough over enough years and found nothing, that we eventually got to the point where we decided our wintering system was solid enough, we didn't need to do that. But very essential to do it, in my view, after weaning. Personally, I used to give them 2 to 3 weeks after weaning before I did it, because there was a percentage of that flock that had put a lot into their lambs, and I want to give them the opportunity to come back from that. If I was concerned about any ewes a couple of months after weaning, I would do it again then. And also, if there's a requirement sort of 6 weeks before mating, but frankly any closer than that, and I feel it, you're running out of time to influence that too much, it needs to be in advance enough. With my clients, particularly hill country clients, often their ewes are going out onto summer country, then they're not very accessible. So it's incredibly important for them to do that job before those ewes go up to summer country and the lighter ewes are held back and don't go there. It's equally important that ewes come off that country in enough time that they can actually be given the proper feed and the proper lift prior to seeing a ram. I think there's a balance of practicality with that as well. I've always been of the view that stock don't put weight on when they're in the yards. And so you try to minimise the number of times you get them into the yards, and when they are in the yards, you do as many jobs as you possibly can. And really, it would, in my position as an advisor now, what I would recommend would very much depend on how much help I felt the stock needed and the farmer needed. The lighter condition the ewes were in, and very much it depends on what the farmer believes is good enough. But I would recommend up to 5 or 6 times a year. Mm-hmm. If I believe that stock needed it enough.
Yep. So there was a couple of key words there in what you were talking, Peter, was around individuals versus averages, you know, and that's where body condition scoring lets you take out individuals and treat them on that basis rather than trying to lift the whole mob on average another 5 or 6 kilos, which often happens with weighing. When people are doing, what sort of proportion of the mob are you often seeing people have to take out and look after with light ewes?
Depends how long I've been working with them, Aaron. But often, very often, it's not much more than 10 or 15%.
Yep.
If it is regularly considerably more than that, I think there's deeper issues. either overstocking or having to or running stock on country that's not suited to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if farmers are regularly getting more than 10% of light ewes in their mob, we need to look at other things.
Yep. Yeah, so it's a good measure of the whole system, not just of
yes,
the
it is.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because, you know, we talk about these things, and I know we're talking to one of your clients who had 16,500 ewes and was able to make some fairly significant gains. But his comment was it just made it so much easier because it actually focused on the animals that needed it rather than trying to lift the entire 16,500 ewes to a higher plane, which would have taken an enormous amount of feed.
It certainly allows for better feed use efficiency when you can target that feed to the animals that truly need it. And with the fertility in a lot of ewe flocks now, some farmers actually don't want their heavier ewes getting too heavy and going from 3 to 4 lambs. So being able to target that has got quite a few benefits.
How, last sort of question on body condition score, but you know, we may come back if there's other questions coming. How hard is it, or how much time do you have to spend to teach somebody to do it if they've never done it before?
It's not that difficult. It's really about people doing enough of it to be confident that they understand what is good enough and what is not good enough. You know, the specific scoring in condition scoring is important when you're relating that to other people or other properties or whatever. But at the very base level, if you're just condition scoring your own sheep, as long as you are very clear about what is good enough, what that condition score 3 threshold feels like, and what it feels like when they're below that. And also, increasingly, I think it's becoming more important for people to understand what anything over a condition score 4 feels like too. And if people are just trying to manage within those two scores, as long as they're very, very clear in their mind what that feels like, that's the key thing. But if they're relating that information to other people, then they actually need to be quite accurate about the allocating the scores to a particular condition.
Yep. And yeah, last one, just to wrap up, I've seen exactly the same as Peter commented on, people who are always surprised when they actually put their hands on stock, even if they've run them closely through the drafting gate and think they've had a close look at them. So weighing, very objective way of assessing. Body condition scoring is a more or less objective way of keeping an eye on stock, but you're also big on, and in the notes you gave me beforehand, stressing some of those things that can be best described as stockmanship. Observation, you use the words constant vigilance and awareness of stock behavior. And again, that was something you were known for. Give us some examples of what you're talking about there, the sort of things you observed, or rumor had it used to spend a fair bit of time out watching sheep.
That doesn't sound too good, Aaron. I'm certainly aware of the way sheep behave, and I was very aware of the fact that sheep behave differently in different paddocks, and I applied that to the way I shepherded them at lambing. And for example, I would have different shaped paddocks, and some were long and skinny, for example, and there was a lot of movement in those paddocks. And you would think of ways to minimize that movement, which contributed to mismothering. And there are times when I've observed different things happening at lambing, and I'll give you one example. I had ewes in probably too heavy a condition leading into lambing, and I'd used ram harnesses to take off the first 9 days and the second 9 days, and it became obvious to me early on in one lambing beat that there was more lambs than normal that weren't bonding to ewes in my twinning mob. And it was pretty obvious which ewes they belonged to, and I would try to mother them on, and the ewes would have nothing to do with them. So I did observe what was going on, spent time watching what was happening, and it was pretty clear that the ewes were that heavy, they weren't actually getting to their feet after delivering the first lamb, and that lamb was big and strong and on his feet pretty quickly and looking to bond with somebody and not getting any joy out of mum. So they would head away to the nearest ewe and try to get a drink off her. And that meant that there was more ewes than I would normally expect just rearing one lamb, or I was having to do a bit of work to make sure they reared both of them. Now, by accident, the second half of the first cycle ewes had a bit more distance to walk to get their daily break of young grass and off, and it was getting a bit short supplied, so I cut their break back slightly, and so they were slightly lower condition and a lot fitter by the time I set stock them for lambing. Now, the first half of the first cycle tailed 185% through the pen, and the second half of the first cycle tailed 199 point something through the pen. And that was just by accident, a change in management for the last 10 days. And so that's an example of finding something out, and something really worked incredibly well by accident, but then, and subsequently making sure that I incorporated that into my management from then on. So I made sure that they were well exercised and fit, and they were only ever set stocked within 1 or 2 or 3 days of their due date of lambing. And that overcame a lot of issues.
So I want to pick up on that one, because that's something I've heard other people pick up. I've seen people who've implemented it have noticed the differences made. When you're talking about exercising these ewes, what are you talking? How far were you walking them? How fast? What were you, you know, what's the fitness regime you were putting in place for your...
I was walking them at least half a K each way, if not further. And in the morning when I would release them down the lane to go to that paddock, I didn't just open the gate and allow them to waddle their way there. I actually was behind them and had them stepping out. I didn't ask them to run, but I kept them honest, put it that way. And I found that that was a way to pick up on any ewes that were just slightly fragile, probably 1 or 2 days earlier than you would otherwise notice them, and by that stage you can treat them with whatever you like, and the success rate's very poor. But in this situation, if I found anything that was just stepping a bit short at the back of the mob, I would simply open a gate in the lane and let them into a paddock of grass, and that's where they lambed.
So they were sleepy sickness or early signs of it is what you're picking, or just could have been anything?
Well, yeah, I think it could have been, and it's an issue more with triplets, obviously. They just simply struggle to have the capacity in their room and to supply. And that's probably one of the disadvantages in shifting a daily break and giving them access to that for most of the day. But when they're at that stage, they probably need access to feed 24 hours of the day. And my system didn't allow for that. So, and saying that, my losses were extremely low. If you did that correctly, and you identified those ewes soon enough, and you gave them a paddock, and I would only have 2 or 3 ewes in each paddock sometimes, and we're only talking less than 20 ewes, but it's 20 ewes that didn't die unnecessarily.
And take their lambs with them.
Yeah.
And that exercising regime was just sort of in the last couple of weeks before lambing?
Yes, particularly in the last couple of weeks. And I feel that delaying set stocking before lambing was as much about not overfeeding them, because I tried to lamb on really good spring covers. It was not only about them eating too much in the period before they lambed, it was also about the loss of fitness through not having to walk to get a feed. When I again stumbled on that, I guess I noticed that I was having to assist a few more ewes after day 11 or 12 after set stocking, and that's what prompted me to bring a harness colour forward from day 14 to day 9. And it pretty much eliminated that problem. So it's got massive implications in terms of being able to control their intake in late pregnancy, both in years of feast and in years of famine too. It's another accident was a year we had 2 years of drought, and I had very little young grass to grass my ewes on in that last 3 to 4 weeks before lambing. And so thanks to a ram harness and scanning, I was able to only grass my twinning ewes within 2 weeks of their due date. And the singles got grain and silage, and the twins got 50% of their ration and silage prior to going on the grass. And through recording my deaths quite accurately for many years, when I look back at the deaths that year, I found I had half the deaths in my ewes pre-lamb that I'd normally had. And that told me very quickly that I was probably overfeeding my ewes prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it just pulling the harness date forward allowed me to control the intakes of my ewes a lot more accurately right up till the day I set stock them, and that was incredibly valuable.
I want to pick up on something you covered in there, and I suspect a few of the listeners heard it as well. You talked about how you observed lamb behaviour and bonding and the ability of the mother to get up, but you also said you set stock at the very last minute, which would sometimes advised against, and that you want to set ewes early, let them have time to settle into a paddock, pick out where they're going to lamb, and that sort of. You didn't see issues with them. I think I remember hearing you say once, so long as you had one or two lambs drop in the yards when you're sorting them, you had the timing right. So, you don't hold to that theory. You'll hold them to the last minute before you put them in their lambing paddocks.
Again, it's horses for courses. About a third of our property was a hill block that went up to 900 metres, and I set stock that a week ahead of the start of lambing because they needed time to climb the hill and get to where they needed to be. I firmly believe that within minutes of ewes getting into a paddock, they know where they are, they know which paddock they're in, and it takes them no time at all to understand where they want to be. I simply don't think that they need a number of days to decide where they want to lamb. And I think our results would bear that out. We consistently tailed 195% in our multiple mobs through the pen, and you know, several times tailed in excess of 200% through the pens. Now, if they needed that time to sort their nest out, we simply wouldn't have been achieving that.
Yeah, so the benefits of exercise, careful feed management, all that were more than outweighing. Yeah.
Obviously. Absolutely. I think exercise is paramount. If you're trying to feed your stock properly and you're trying to ensure that they're lambing on good covers to, you know, protect ewe condition, milking ability, lamb growth, weaning weights, and on it goes, there are other issues that come with that that you need to find ways to adapt your management to overcome. And it doesn't necessarily have to be ram harnesses now. Like fetal aging is pretty accurate now. But I think we need to utilise those tools to the best we can to just go to that next level. Genetics take you so far, but then they will plateau, and it's down to our management to extract as much of that potential from those genetics as we can. And that's where attention to detail comes in.
So, and that was next question about the ram harnesses, and again, you're well known for investing in ram harnesses, but fetal aging, what sort of band are the scanners able to get the fetal aging down to? It's similar to the 9 days you were doing with the crayons?
I recall a roadshow that we ran with the late Errol Holgate, and there was a well-known scanner at one of those meetings, and he was confident that he could scan with a high degree of accuracy down to 10 days. And the bandwidth, if we can call it that, depends on a number of issues and what you're trying to achieve. For us, there was no advantage in making those bands too big, otherwise we didn't get the number of ewes we required to manipulate our spring management enough. And you know, fertile ewes now that are well managed, there's less than 10% of them in the second cycle, including tutus. And so unless you pull that bandwidth down to less than 10 days, you're simply not getting the critical mass you require to actually manipulate your management much.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Moving on a bit. Hoggett lambing. You tell us what you did and why, or what you didn't do at Aotearoa and why you didn't do it, but also what you've seen in your travels and your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think Hoggett lambing's a fantastic innovation when it's well done. It's incredibly profitable. I think there are environments where it's less advisable, and it was a conscious decision on our part not to lamb our hoggets because of the high risk of summer drought and the high risk of extremely severe winters. And I really value the importance of ensuring young stock are grown out properly, having seen what it costs when they're not, with only 60% of our 2-3 rearing lambs the first year we were there. So extremely conscious of the importance of that. I would possibly, if I was still on the same property, I would possibly revisit that option with a lucerne based dry land system and possibly reducing the ewe numbers a bit. But it would be very cautious. I'd be very cautious about it. I've been to a number of clearing sales in the area over many years, and frequently those ewes that lambed as hoggets were having to be sold separately as tutus from the dry tutus because they just couldn't be picked up. It was too tough on them. And I believe those things penalise an animal for the rest of their lives. So you've got one opportunity to get it right. And so very much it's horses for courses, and there are environments where hoggett lambing fits and it can be done extremely well, and it is extremely profitable.
Mm-hmm. So again, it's horses for courses, and without being too specific, but what are some of the basics you'd need to see in place, or the criteria that need to be met before you think it would be a goer? I mean, the profit on paper is one thing, but you're going to have to have actually achieving it and getting good tutus back in the flock.
I'd need to have a high degree of confidence that I could feed them absolutely as well as they needed to be fed, right through until they saw a ram as a rising tutus. Uh-huh. That's paramount for me, really. There's some debate around appropriate live weights for mating hoggets, and I just have a personal view on that. I believe the more challenging your winter is, the higher those live weights need to be in hoggets before you're prepared to mate them, because it's quite difficult to continue putting much weight on them over the winter sometimes. So I think the principles are well known, it's well documented, there's been a lot of really good work done on what's required to lamb hoggets successfully. Again, I think the trick in that is applying those principles to specific environments and farming situations. As I said, when you knock a hogget around, you've penalised her for the rest of her life.
Just out of interest, how big were your hoggets in May, typically, at the start of winter?
Well, I think we weighed them for the national hog competition 1 year, and they were 52 or something like that, from memory. I worked on the philosophy of growing my hoggets as well as I could while I could, because we never knew when the next dry patch or whatever was around the corner. So we capitalised on the opportunity when it arose and made the most of it.
So, and there's a point that you talked about, you know, a whole cohort, a whole year of your sheep flock being poor because they were caught in a drought and not dealt with, or lambed as hoggets when they shouldn't have been, and that flows through for their life. But bringing that back again to managing individual ewes, are there things you would record about individual ewes or try to track, you know, with an ear tag or in her ear, that you would use for culling decisions, or a ewe that would go to the terminal side, things, you know, two strikes and you're out, or those sorts of things?
It was interesting at the at the stock count and the valuation when we sold the farm, the stock agent offered to draft the ewes, and then he took one look at them with three tags in one ear and one in the other. This was before EID. So he politely declined and said, perhaps I better take the gate. And I think, you know, the progress you make in your flock is very heavily reliant on those culling and selection decisions you make. And everybody will have different priorities in terms of what they regard as most important to cull for. And I think part of what I do now is to help make farmers aware of what they need in their ewes. And for those people who, for example, are lambing on hill country and they cannot go anywhere near their ewes, they need to have a ewe that successfully brings lambs into the pen at weaning, not just at tailing. And so you base your culling criteria around that. And I've always been quite hard on myself, really. If I had wet, dry ewes or whatever, I would make sure that it wasn't my fault rather than their fault. I think there's probably been a lot of perfectly good ewes that have been culled through no fault of their own. And I would use overfeeding and lack of fitness as one example of where you can have issues crop up that are management related, not a failing on the ewes part. So I think we need to be pretty considered and understand pretty clearly what it is we're trying to achieve in our flock when we decide what our priorities are for culling and selection.
Just get into some specific things around how you manage the place. Now, you didn't grow, you're in an environment, Tirihua, for people again that don't know exactly where it is, you're within a stone's throw where they hold the Brass Monkey Rally each Queen's birthday just passed, give you an idea of what the winters are like. But you didn't grow winter crop, which would seem, you know, the first thing you would do in an environment like that is try and have a store of feed for the winter. So
I grew crop for the hoggets, and you know, there were times when bulbs on the turnips froze solid and you couldn't even get the electric fence standards into them. And that's where we went to after the ground froze. We put the standards into the turnips and periodically they froze that much that you couldn't get it in there either, so it was pointless putting them on it because the bulbs were that hard, the hoggets, you know, just rubbing teeth out. But I placed a lot of emphasis on knowing my target covers in the autumn, what I had to achieve at a given date, and that happened to be 1st of April, to ensure that my whole production cycle continued to work. And part of that was a pretty disciplined once over grazing rotation, which happened to start on the 13th of May when my second mating cycle began. Actually, that was coincidental, but I tried to coincide that with the time when soil temperatures got low enough that any regrowth in our pastures were actually not due to temperature but more on root reserves, so that I protected those root reserves. So I'd work out a grazing rotation, and that grazing rotation would take me through until around the middle of August, sometimes early August, and we would have young grass paddocks that were sown in the summer or early autumn the previous season. I would take them through the winter because they would handle the frost and wouldn't get frostburnt, and I would rely on those young pastures for ewes in that last 4 weeks, 6 weeks if it was a good winter and spring. And that system worked fantastically well. The growth rates in the pasture in the spring were noticeably faster than I could see elsewhere in the district because I'd protected the root reserves. And we were lambing 10 days earlier than one of our neighbours and consistently had more feed at the same time when we did it. And I put that down entirely to that grazing rotation over the winter. And it fitted brilliantly well too with the harnesses, because those ewes that were lambing later weren't being set stocked, and those later grazed paddocks had more time to recover before they were lambed on. So it worked incredibly well, and we got, you know, very, very few metabolic issues leading up to lambing, because ultimately pasture's the best thing you can give them.
particularly in late pregnancy, which leads on to another point. You were, again, had a reputation getting out very early, feeding supplement in winter, whereas you must have told it later, and that ties in with wanting to carry pasture through.
I would work out my winter rotation and try to move ewes on before day four, certainly no longer than 4 days in any one break. Mm-hmm. I would not strip graze, I would sort of block graze my paddocks. Mm-hmm. And frequently, depending on what the autumn was like, that I would get two days out of those four without having to feed supplements, but I was more than happy to feed supplements at any time of the year when I was in a deficit. But frequently I'd start in that middle of May period, much to the amusement of my neighbours who couldn't understand why I was feeding and I had all this grass in front of me. But I was very much of the view that the grass continued to grow to some degree through the winter, and I've spoken to various plant experts on that, and they agree it's possible if you have the leaf area and you get sunshine, you'll get photosynthesis happening and you'll get some degree of growth. And so I was noticing quite a big improvements in pasture covers from when I plated those paddocks in the middle of May to when I would get to some of them in July and August. So the philosophy was to ration that feed out, push covers in front of me and allow them to build, because I'm yet to see a silage stack get bigger when you don't use it.
And the demand, the need for high quality feeds that much higher in later winter, particularly with the lambing percentages you were getting.
Yeah, well, it worked that as I progressed through winter, I was feeding less supplements, and so a higher proportion of their diet was grass. And of course, I saved the higher quality younger paddocks to the end of that rotation, so they retained their quality better, and it was just a really good fit for the demands of the ewes. And they held their condition extremely well. I almost always had complaints from the shearers, which every farmer wants.
Do you think, you know, you had some obvious physical reasons, let's say, for not growing supplements with the way the winters were and things turning to blocks of ice, but there's always a cost to growing a supplement crop and taking it into winter. It costs you in the area and grass growing over the summer, spring, autumn, spring, summer. Do you think we, through better pasture management, could grow less supplement crop? Are we, you know, costing ourselves in the long run with the amount of winter feed that we do grow in some places?
I think, you know, ground conditions dictate to some extent how you can winter your stock. And we also need to ensure that we maintain a level of pasture renewal as well. There's probably generally agreed that pasture renewal rates are not as high as they need to be. And so we need to renew those pastures one way or the other. And winter crop is a traditional way of doing that, of course. It's really a personal choice I had. A lot of other people in farming and in central Otago certainly grow crops for their ewes. It was a system that I found worked exceptionally well for us. And I mean, ultimately the proof of that pudding is in the performance of the stock and the condition of the stock through the winter and the sort of deaths you have. Mm. I mean, that to me is the real measure of a system working or not working.
Mm. So I wanted to, we talked earlier about you're observing your animals, but you spend a lot of time considering causes of death and stock losses as an indicator as well, in terms of what was going on or what wasn't going on properly on your place.
Yeah, well, I think every property has got its optimum scanning percentage, if I can say that. Mm-hmm. And for us, we didn't actually want any more multiples because of the area of dry land we had and the exposure we had to dry springs. So looking to improve our performance further, I then looked quite hard at reducing wastage. And part of that wastage, not only lamb wastage, but ewe wastage. And so I took pretty accurate records of ewe deaths, instead of just picking ewes up and throwing them in the hole to tidy the place up, I was taking note of the age of the ewe that died, and if there was an obvious cause of that death, I would record that. If I didn't know, I didn't guess, because that only creates uncertainty. And I was also quite careful. I recorded deaths in bands. Didn't really worry too much over winter because I didn't have any deaths over winter. And I started recording in bands from scanning through till a month pre-lamb, and then in that separately in the final month pre-lamb, and then I would record deaths again during lambing, and then for the month after lambing. And so the combination of getting an idea of the age of the ewes that might have died and potential cause, but more importantly when they died, proved to be really valuable information to allow me to try and fine tune the management. And I frequently advise clients that I suspect might be retaining ewes for 1 or 2 years too long, to just keep track of how many of those older ewes are still there at the end of the year. And if it's significantly higher than your average ewe death rate, that's telling you that, you know, there's some benefits in tidying up the age structure in your ewe flock and maybe keeping a few more replacements.
Just one specific question going back to, we're talking about winter feeding. Fodder beets sort of become a major part of the sheep and beef industry, and it's probably since you left the farm, but you will have seen it in your advisory work. Any thoughts on how it fits in a sheep system in particular, and how to make it work for feeding ewes in winter, or even early, you know, late spring, autumn, early spring, because it's such a versatile crop?
I'm certainly aware of a few clients using it on ewes, and I have a couple of clients using it on for hoggets. I think we have to be aware that it's different from your typical brassicas. It's an incredible crop that's doing some marvellous things, but we need to be careful just how we use it. There's people very successfully using it to winter their ewes. We just need to be aware that it doesn't have the same protein levels in it that your typical brassicas have, particularly relating to young sheep that still need to grow. But certainly it has a place, and if on the very intensive properties they are limited in the area that they can grow crops in, it's definitely a way to get a lot of kilograms of dry matter in a small area. That certainly help with those areas that are pretty intensively stocked. There's a number of properties in this region that I deal with that don't have the issue of a shortage of land. They actually have an issue of not renewing their pastures fast enough. And so to me, the advantages in that particular case are limited. And so again, horses for courses. Certainly you can manage ewes quite successfully on fodder beet.
Have you noticed anything, you know, the good management practice rules to transitioning and managing it for cattle and so on? Have you noticed anything different or heard of anything different and required for ewes on it?
Well, ewes, they're not as susceptible to acidosis by any means, but I think we need to still be very aware that it is a pretty significant feed change, and the gut does take time to adjust, and we need to be very careful about the times we select to start ewes on crops or any stock on crops. We don't want to create that bit of stress that's related to a gut change at a period of time that's quite critical in that production cycle, whether it's pregnancy or pre-mating or pre-lamb. We just need to be mindful of the fact that it is a gut change and it takes some time to adapt, and effectively they almost starve if we try to make that new feed the total part of their diet. So I think it's important to have a constant in their diet, when they are making that change, and it certainly reduces that stress involved around a big fee change like that.
Yep. And just a plug, we have got a very popular podcast with Jim Gibbs on the channel if you're wanting to have a look. And he makes that same point more or less, that a lot of the issues that are attributed to fodder beet aren't necessarily something like acidosis. It's just managing that transition and like any change in diet. But look, I'm just looking at time and I've got one last topic I want to bring up, and I hope I'm not going to regret it, Peter, but you mentioned the P word, protein. And there's been a fair bit of debate around this, and I know you, your observation and your experience with other farmers, you've got some thoughts on what we are starting to see out there with lucerne-based pastures or pure lucerne, and even some, you know, well-fed or perhaps the use of nitrogen fertilizer and so on pastures. What do you talk about that a wee bit?
Yeah, well, I believe that the very thing that gives New Zealand farmers the international competitiveness that we have is that clover-based pastoral grazing system that we have in New Zealand. And it's an incredible advantage that we have, but I think it's made us less aware of the importance of a full nutritionally balanced diet, because for most of the year, pasture meets most of the nutritional requirements of our stock. So we have less awareness of what is a fully balanced diet than, say, our Northern Hemisphere farming counterparts who house animals for extended periods of time and need to provide 100% of their diet. So as we ramp up the production from our animals and we introduce these specialist feeds and concentrates, I think it's pretty important that we understand rumen function, basically, and realize that as soon as we introduce some of these different feeds and we grow some of these highly digestible specialist finishing pastures, for example, that there are other issues potentially that can crop up from that. And I have seen, and I experienced it myself on our own property, we had what was called protein overload in our lambs, and just really high protein levels in our autumn pastures. And I've subsequently since seen herbage tests with crude protein levels in excess of 36%. And consulting with nutritionists, I'm told that animals don't require anything over 22% protein, and that it starts to become an issue if it's over 25% protein. And so I think that if we have a particularly good summer and legume activity is really strong and there's been a lot of nitrogen cycling in the pastures, then when we get into that autumn period and growth slows down, there's an accumulation of nitrogen in the soil there that probably concentrates more highly in the leaf, and that of course translates into higher protein levels. And I think we need to better understand how we can manage that and alleviate some of the issues that are associated with that, particularly around growth rates in young stock. We're seeing growth rates in lambs in the autumn drop off quite dramatically, and people see that and they see them scouring and they automatically think they need straw or something to bind them up. But in my understanding, which is reasonably limited, it's more to do with an imbalance in energy and protein. So I think we need to get some nutrition experts in the field to give us a little bit more advice in that area and help us through that, because we are growing more quality pastures, and with that comes some more issues around nutrition and how animals deal with it.
Yeah, and I think the thing, and you and I were discussing this before the call, is on top of what we're growing, the animals are only eating the very best of it as well. And particularly in the case of lucerne is a good example, where they're not eating the whole plant, they're picking out some of the, which may have the highest protein content. But look, I'm sounding like a broken record, but I would refer you, we've also got a conference call where we discuss this in depth on our podcast channel with a nutritionist from South Australia by the name of San Jolly, and she'd said and talked in some detail and had observed basically the same stuff as Peter was talking about there. But look, I'm looking at the time. We've gone a wee bit over time, but we were getting into some of those topics that were really interesting. So we have come to the end of the time. I think we do need to call it to a close. So many thanks to those of you out there who are listening to the call, to those of you who've dialed in and listened, those of you who've sent in some questions as we've gone. As I said at the start, the recording will be up on the podcast channel very soon if you want to listen again or share with your friends and colleagues, and we'll send you an email when that's ready. And in that email, we'll include some links to some of the resources and topics we've discussed, such as body condition scoring. I really enjoy all these conference calls. They're, I shouldn't probably say this in front of Peter, but they're almost a perk to my job, getting to talk with people about these sorts of topics. But I think tonight's been an even more special one than usual. There's a lot of ideas out there, but what you've heard tonight is somebody who has put them into practice on his own property and not just talking about them in theory. So thanks, Pete. There was some gold in there tonight. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Aaron. No problem.